to make a start, I'm very pleased indeed to welcome Professor Graham Schweig from the Christopher Newport University in Virginia, where Graham teaches, and I'm sure you know his work. He's done research on the devotional traditions of India. He's done a translation of the Gita, if I recall, and the Bhakti Sutras of Narada.
On its way,
yes.
Colombia.
And today he's going to speak to us on the tantric dimensions of the Rasa Mandala, the Bhagavata Rasa Leela, and the artistic imagination. It sounds really interesting. So, Graham, over to you. Thank you for coming in this
way
to speak.
Well, thanks. Well, I was kind of forced. Thanks to you and your student.
Yes, okay. Thanks, Gavin.
My pleasure.
Yes. In any case,
this presentation sort of moves out of an invitation I had gotten from the chair of the Tantric Studies panel group at the American Academy of Religion. So I was drafted into doing a presentation for them. And so here I'm trying to take it a little further. So, and you know, it's interesting because I'm visiting sort of my original work, my first publication. I'm revisiting it, but with the lens of the tantric sort of angle, and because it's not something that I looked at all in the book that I originally published with Princeton. So what was fun doing this is that new things came out about something I thought, of course, I knew, you know, fairly thoroughly. But now I'm wondering, you know, maybe I really need to go much further into this. And so in some ways I raise maybe some more questions rather than what I answer. I think some remarkable things come out. Given the fact that people like David White, and others have said that, that Tantra colors all of Indic traditions. Remember, you could see...
I don't have a chair.
No, there is a chair. There are two chairs. How many chairs is Rumber? Okay, anyway.
Okay, that's fine. Oh, you brought in two chairs.
You're going to be in that corner? Okay, good. I'm just at this point where I'm talking, Rembrandt, that I'm revisiting my old work, but with this tantric inquiry, to see how much there is a tantric dimension to the Rasa Leela in general, and, you know, what forms might that be? What influences might there have been in this Leela? And how does it relate to bhakti? So what I've done here then is I'm looking at I'm looking at the narrative of the Rasa Leela first. And I'm looking at ways that you could read the tantric elements of it. And then secondly, and this will be kind of the major portion of the presentation, I'm looking at the Rasa Mandala representation itself. And as you may know, this Rasa Mandala is painted hundreds, thousands of times by Indian artists. Even I painted one, not directly, but indirectly, working with a Rajasthani artist, and you'll see, in fact, whoops, that's the blurb. That's the one that appears in the Princeton book and as a grayscale, but I actually commissioned this, and I'm sort of looking back at why did I commission it? Well, given the fact that there are literally thousands of paintings from which I could have chosen, right? I painted it because I wanted a Rasa Mandala painting to be as close to the actual text itself. Now, that's sort of funny that I would want to do that. I mean, I understand why he wanted to do that, but now I'm looking at the different Ras Mandala paintings to see how they sort of depart from the text. And that's what I call the artistic imagination. And I put on Facebook that I was going to be doing this with this title, and someone, I think someone, a Hindu practitioner, said, what does imagination have to do with this? And of course, I explained that actually, there's a place for imagination. So we're going to talk about how the imagination of the artist, when rendering Ras Mandala depictions, in a way, is really being activating this tantric dimension, envisioning things going on in the Leela that really aren't even talked about. And that, of course, is what generates so much esoteric mystical literature based on the Ras Leela in the Bhakti traditions, is the filler part, you know. And of course, you see this happening with the Song of Solomon, for example. You see this happening with the story of Leila Majnun, the Arabic tale, and the Sufi mystics. The parts that aren't talked about is an option, is a great opportunity to envision flourishes and envision all kinds of events that were a part of this Leela. So to fill out the Leela. Now, what I've done here is What I've done here is I've outlined, I think, about 12 tantric sort of principles that are brought out that I think one could see occurring in the Leela. Okay? So you let me know if it's convincing. Okay? So in Tantra, I think there are 12, yeah. In Tantra, we find the primacy of Shakti, or the divine feminine. So the prominence of the feminine voice of the Vrajalila, of the Vrajagopikas in this passage, is also the greatest among all the Bhagavata's Leelas. So again, similar to the Song of Solomon in the biblical context, there is no greater prominence of the feminine voice anywhere in the Bhagavata than in the Ras Leela. And in fact, I counted them, the proportions. Out of the 164 verses, well, there are 173 verses, out of the 164, which can be identified as verses containing descriptions or possessing words of either Krishna or the Vrajagopikas, the balance of the 9 verses are more narrative verses. 111 and a half are attributed to the gopis, whereas only 52 and a half are attributed to Krishna. So there's more than twice as much are spoken by the gopis. So right there you have the presence of the feminine. And in many ways, and we'll talk about this, the divine feminine. 2, the presence of the goddess as Yoga Maya has a supremely powerful function within the story. Now, I've just gotten through reading a thesis on Maya, and this is unofficial, so it's all right to say, an excellent thesis on Maya, in which this is pursued in great detail. You'll have to wait for his book to come out. But anyway, but here, the presence of the goddess as Yoga Maya has a supremely powerful function within the story. Now, this is not something that is new in my presentation here, because I bring out how this is the only place, and I think soon-to-be Dr. Gupta can confirm this, because he's done the comprehensive study on Maya throughout the Bhagavata, but the use of Yoga Maya in this first verse, this very beautiful, simple, unashtub first verse. Bhagavan apitaratri sharadot kullamallika vikcharantu manas chakre yogamayam upashritaha. This is the only instance in which... Oh, you confirm it in your thesis. Now I remember. Yeah, you confirm this. So, I've been confirmed. This is the only instance in which Krishna himself becomes subsumed by that energy fully. He takes full refuge, right? My translation, even the beloved Lord, seeing those nights in autumn filled with blooming jasmine flowers, turned his mind toward love's delights, fully taking refuge in Yogamaya's creative powers. So, clearly, right at the outset, the power of the goddess is right there. And as we know in great Sanskrit literature and dramaturgy, initial verses are very important. They act as bijas for the rest of the text. So, and I have more to say about that. Let me see what's going on here. Do I have anything? Oh, okay. Very good. Okay, yeah. First, good. I'm good here. I'm coordinated somehow. That's great. Okay, yes, the first verse, the bija. So, in this comes out that God passionately loves souls, being himself conquered by beauty and love. Okay. Now, this conquering, his ability to be conquered is due to the power of the goddess. Okay, number three, the female heroines of the story are compared to Krishna's shaktis. Okay, here. Do I do anything on that? No. Okay, don't look at that. You didn't see the other slide yet. Okay, so there's a verse where it is stated, like the Supreme Person with his splendorous powers, Purusha Shaktibir Yatha. So there is this allusion to the gopis as really his shaktis. Okay. So let's see here. Now, along with other explicitly announced principles of the drama. Okay, here we go. In the first verse, the Vrajagopikas are most powerfully yet subtly presented in the verse by way of a complex or multi-layered metaphor, which is itself circuitous. So, what I have found in the first verse is an announcement of the four principles. Three are obvious. Bhagavan, Krishna, right? The scenery, the Vraja scenery. And these I go into extensively in my book, right? And the third is Yogamaya, right? The phrase Yogamaya is right there. But where are the gopis? Where are the gopis? Everything else is in the first verse, but where are the gopis? On first viewing of it, they appear to be missing, but they're actually not. Now, of course, there we go. So, the beloved Lord, the hero who takes full refuge in love, paradisial scenery, the uniting power of love is yoga maya, the divine feminine power of yoga. And then fourth, the cowherd maidens, the heroines of the drama, who are hidden in the verse. I'm going to show you where they are. Okay. I'm going to take you through this complex metaphor. Autumn nights with night blooming jasmine decorating the dark nights. Okay. So, in a metaphor, as I think probably all of us know, there's a vehicle and there's a tenor, right? Now, there's also the grounds of the metaphor, which is what is held in common. Now, of course, I'm doing Western poetics here, okay? I'm doing Western poetics, and my excuse for that is really a hermeneutical approach to the... Because this could be analyzed from a kavya standpoint. But I'm really looking at this as literature that we can understand in the West. So I'm sort of taking the liberty to analyze this in a kind of... using literary criticism and analyzing what's going on in the imagery itself, but understanding that imagery in light of the original text. So here, autumn nights. The word is ratri. Well, you know, any of us who know Sanskrit know there are many words for night that could have been used. And Ratri, of course, is the feminine gender of Ratra. So the feminine gender is used here. Okay? So this vehicle really points to the tenor, the Vedic goddesses, Ratri, whose dark hair is decorated in jasmine. So I realized that the Vedic goddess Ratri was this kind of subtle allusion to the gopis. And of course, Krishna is gazing out at the forest. The forest is dark at night, but it's decorated. The forest is decorated. The trees and the limbs and so on are like the gopis themselves, but the jasmine is like, you know, like the hair. I mean, what do young Indian women often do? They wear jasmine in their hair. I mean, I've seen it myself when I lived in India, okay? It's commonly done. And so then this tenor itself becomes the vehicle of the second level of the metaphor. So the Vedic goddesses, whose dark hair is decorated with jasmine, are you know, alluding to the cowherd maidens, whose behavior is like that of jasmine. Why is their behavior like that? Like that of jasmine? Well, jasmine comes out in the spring and the summer, right? So this is the autumn. Jasmine's not supposed to be coming out now. And neither are the gopis supposed to be coming out of their homes. So there's something that the gopis have in common with jasmine. Well, first of all, the gopis are beautiful. Okay? And they're also night blooming. The gopis are leaving their homes at night. This is night blooming jasmine. So you've got this level of the metaphor coming up here. Let's get a picture of the whole thing. That tenor, second tenor, then becomes the third vehicle, which then points to autumn nights with, well, night-blooming jasmine decorating the dark nights. So, in other words, they become a vehicle for understanding this special autumn event of night-blooming jasmine, which then takes you right back to... Oops. Yeah, I'm going the wrong direction here. Which takes you back to the beginning again. So in a way, you go from autumn nights to the Vedic goddesses to the cowherd maidens who act just like night-blooming jasmine in autumn, and then you start the whole thing over again. So it's circuitous. And so what you've got here then is a kind of mandala, a sort of a mandala of imagery right there in the first verse, and that's how the gopis are present in the first verse, with this imagery of the nights and night blooming jasmine and these sort of tropes. Not only that, but if you look at the whole narration, you've got a kind of movement. I've analyzed the five chapters is really acts. And as we know in Sanskrit dramaturgy, you have really dramas consisting of 5 to 10 acts. Okay? And I've also analyzed where the scenes would naturally fall. And there are 13 different scenes. And when you look at this beautiful symmetry here, you also have an interesting kind of circuitous movement as well. Now let me explain what this is. Each of these scenes eventually moves around like this in the interactions between the gopis and Krishna. There are 9. Now, in my book I only come up with 8, but I've corrected it. There are 9. The one I dropped, the one I didn't really notice because it only... After the final chapter, when the rasa dance takes place, and the gopis and Krishna are playing in the forest, well, there's only one verse that says that they went home, but you know that's significant. Returning, they did return. Okay, even though they didn't have to because they had another body waiting there, They had a right that shadow body. I think he used Chaya, right? They had that third body. There are really three bodies the gopis have. Remember, there's that body that they have when they're running out to the forest. At that point, the narrator explains that they completely abandoned a body consisting of the three elements. So they have something. They have a non-physical body of some kind at that point. So there's sort of a death, but not exactly, because the cowherd men are appeased by some kind of replacement. It's sort of like in America. You know, we have the in America we have these during rush hour. You know, they have two people have to be in a car or more. So you can buy these cardboard, figures you put in the front seat that looks like you're... Yeah, I have a few that I like to rotate around so it doesn't look the same. Anyway, I'm sort of embarrassed to tell you about this. Anyway, but that's kind of what it's like. It's not a real person, but yet they thought it was. Same thing with the cops. And they look at cops as a slang word for officer over in America. Okay, so the idea is that we're talking about while they are having this kind of... And again, Tantra seems to come in here because of this, the tremendous value of our human situation and the power that we have as humans, because the gopis were humans, and then somehow they took on this non-physical body and still remained in this world. That's very tantric. Still in this world. Still fulfilling all of the dharmic roles that are expected of them, and yet transcending the dharma. Which is an interesting idea, sort of carrying over in the lunchroom. But whether they do or not. But the idea here then is, in this, I've traced these nine dynamics, and I put them in a circle because in a way, they come right back around again, returning. And in the Chaitanya school, they delight in this whole lila happening over and over again. And the only way it can happen over again is if they return home and they break out of their homes again. They have to go home in order to leave home. You can't leave home if they're not home. So this conveniently, the structure allows this thing to just keep going around and around. So there is this circuitous dimension. And so I show here this awakening to love is scene one. I show you the different scenes. Returning to the place of awakening is in scene 13 in just one or two verses. So I show that, and then you can really... analyze, let's see, why do I have that there? Nine attributes of intensity of love, okay. I'm showing here that the gopis move from the outer world to the inner world to the innermost world and then back to the outer world. Now, the reason I have this here is an anticipation of a yantra. Because a yantra displays this movement from the outer world, which you'll see later, as being squared off, the squared parts of the yantra. The circular parts of the yantra is the inner world, and then the innermost world is like the pod of a flower. Oftentimes the intersecting triangles, multiple triangles that are there at the center of a yantra. I have some illustrations of that coming up. So here are the scenes. So if the lila is taking a place over and over again, right? It looks something like that, right? And I want you to know it took me a lot of time to put those arrows in there. Okay, I just thought it was really clever, but obviously I'm not going to get a lot of appreciation for that. But that's fine. But mainly I want to show that it just there's this kind of repetitive sense of it. So again. I'm thinking of this of the application of yantra in tantric meditation as and the tantric then enters into
this close, this intimate connection with divinity through the machine, if you will, or the use of this yantra meditational diagram. The Leela, the Ras Leela, is itself a kind of yantra narrative, is what I'm trying to say here, in several ways. Now, moving along to another... Okay, we'll get to that. Don't look at that. Okay, before we do that, let me mention that there's this awakening... Tantrism can be associated with yoga, as we know. And there's an awakening of an inner of inner forces, along with perfect lucidity and self-control. These are aspects of Tantra. And we can witness this in the Vrajagopikas. Visualization within one's heart is promoted in the Ras Leela, as well as in Tantrism. Okay, we're going to talk about that. The use of yoga meditation by the Vrajagopikas is utilized to embrace Krishna. You see, what happened was, many of the gopis ran off suddenly when they heard the sound of the flute. Couldn't help themselves. But there's some that got detained by their husbands. They got caught. So they said, well, if we can't go out to be with Krishna and embrace Krishna there in the forest, we'll just go inside and embrace Krishna. And that's what they did. They went into meditation. Some gopis, unable to leave, had gone inside their homes. With eyes closed, fully absorbed in love, they meditated upon Krishna. The intense burning of unbearable separation from their dearest beloved disrupted all inauspiciousness. Due to the joy of embracing Achyuta, attained through meditation, even their worldly happiness was lost. Okay. So, you know, if you can't have it on the outside, go on the inside. Again, a tantric motif right there. What's interesting is that later in the passage, when the gopis are separated from Krishna, Krishna disappears from them. The gopis, they're well known for cursing the creator, right, Brahma, for creating eyelids that blink a nanosecond, disrupting their vision, their ability to gaze upon the beautiful form of Krishna for even a nanosecond, okay? There's nothing about nanoseconds in there, but I'm just giving you my own translation of the translation. And then Krishna shows up, and that's in the third passage, the third chapter. The fourth chapter, Krishna shows up as Shauri, right? Looking very nice. And the gopis are a little upset with him, and you can understand that. He suddenly disappeared, right? But he comes back, and they're really happy about that. They're all sitting around him. And it's described that one gopi closes her eyes. You know, we just got through hearing how they hated eyelids. And now, one of them is closing her eyes. When Krishna's right there in front of her. And the reason she did is because, you know, there are all these other gopis around. And she just wanted to have him to herself. So she went into her heart and embraced Krishna from within. So even when he's right there. Okay. So, again, the emphasis of the power of meditation is certainly there in them. Yes, one of them took him into her heart through the aperture of her eyes. Then closing her eyes, she embraced him within. She became elated with bodily ripplings of joy as the body of a yogi is overcome with bliss. Okay. By the way, bodily ripplings of joy is my way of... elated with bodily ripplings of joy is my protracted translation of, Roma Harshana or Pulika. You know, I just can't say hairs standing on end. I can't do that. It feels horripilation. It's when you read it in Sanskrit, it feels right, but when you translate it away, it just It just doesn't work, I'm telling you, for all kinds of reasons. And I discuss this in my book, and if you don't agree, tough. Okay, now, the power of the feminine over that of divinity is demonstrated by the transformation of Krishna's blue complexion into the color of, quote, Mahamarakataha, magnificent emerald. So this is where let me see what comes next. Oh, don't look at that. You're not allowed to look at that. Okay. This is where the gopis form this interlocking circle, right? They're linking arms in a circle. So the gopis begin the rasa dance, right? Gopi mandala manditaha. The open blossom of the rasa dance, right? The rasotsava. Of course, you could say the festival, but literally the open blossom. Ras utsava, right? Ras sotsava, the open blossom of the rasa dance. So in a way, it's a beautiful image. The way the gopis link arms is like the opening of a blossom. Sampravritta. So it begins with the perfect turning forth of a mandala circle of gopis adorned with rejoicing and praising. So they form this circle, and Krishna, who's at the center, then duplicates himself multiple times, as you know, and enters in between each pair of gopis. When he does so, the description is here. There, glowing brilliantly among them, was the beloved Lord, son of Devaki. In a setting of golden ornaments, he appeared like a magnificent emerald. In the commentary, you read Sridhar's commentary, and he says, basically, Krishna's not green like an emerald. He's blue. He just completely counters the text and doesn't address it. So basically says, it's a mistake. Vishwanatha comes along, and you know, he always saves the day. Vishwanatha, he always makes sense of everybody and adds more sense. At least that's my experience of Vishwanatha when I was reading the commentaries. And he says, of course Krishna is blue. Sridhar is correct. But in such close proximity to the gopis, when you take the two primary colors of yellow and blue, they make green. That's why, but what's interesting here is that Krishna changes color, not the gopis. They still are golden. Krishna's transformed. His color is transformed. That's interesting. And to me, again, the prominence of the feminine, the influence and the power of the feminine. In Tantra erotics, okay, this is another seven. In Tantra, erotic symbolism is a vehicle for yogic states of consciousness. So, clearly, this is, you know, an erotic passage. It's certainly drawing the bhakta into the realm of the greatest lila of the Bhagavata, and I have much discussion about how it is the greatest lila. But really, it's not allegorical, which is an extended metaphor, as you know. In allegory, the vehicle is eventually discarded, and the tenor is ultimately elevated, valued, and made prominent. So it's not just something, the passage is not just something that represents the intimacy with the soul with God, but really, it's these great feminine yoginis, if you will, who are truly powerful in loving the divine. And in effect, even Krishna acknowledges the power of their love in the fourth act, or fourth chapter, and says he doesn't even know if he can even reciprocate the purity of their love. So that's there. So this passage clearly emphasizes the power of the feminine love for the divine. In Tantra, the Shakti, or female energy, is found in conjunction with the male energy, as in Purusha and Prakriti. The Rasmandala displays an even number of male figures interacting with female figures, presenting a balanced dance of divine love, if you will. As a bhakti yantra, the interpenetrating upward and downward pointing triangles, I think now a little bit, there we go. Now, typically this is, okay, here we go, this is the clicker. So the bhakti yantra, now typically this is a Sri yantra. Now, the Sri yantra does have in it the upward pointing triangles, which are said to represent masculine energy or power, and the downward pointing triangles, the feminine. These are interlocking sort of triangles, moving the eye to the center, where ultimately you have emphasis on the feminine, because there's ultimately the downward pointing triangle at the very center. But there's also an upward pointing one, but it's not quite at the center. So to me, the Sri yantra is very much a bhakti yantra symbolizing the Ras Mandala, because of the greater influence that the gopis have over, and the greater presence that the gopis have compared to that of Krishna's. So, let's see what I do with this. So here's the outer world. There's the inner world. And then that area here presents the innermost world and the interest in going deeper and deeper toward the center. And if you study yantras, the divinity that's represented by a yantra is supposed to be right at the center. But here we've got right at the center both feminine and masculine energies, which again I think beautifully depicts what's going on in the Ras Lila. The innermost center is the seat of divinity. Now, what I'm getting at here is that the paintings of the Ras Mandala, in effect, are kind of a bhakti version of a yantra. And I think that's why it's painted so much. You can't have enough Ras Mandala, you know? I mean, you just can't have enough of it. And I'm, by the way, as much as I claimed in the beginning of my talk, that I wanted a Ras Mandala depiction that was as close to the original text as possible, I confess to all of you, because I know you won't take it out of this room, that I also used my imagination. Dr. Valpy, please. Look, I'm trying to confer with friends here, okay? Okay, you're not going to... Can you close that door? No, it's all right. I just don't want anyone to hear outside. And I will fess up toward the end on what I did in the painting that is definitely not in the passage. Only one thing. But you see, you can't help but do it. And I'll show you. But everyone who does a Ras Mandala painting is guilty of it. But yet, should we be guilty? No. It invites that. You can't help it. You have to add something to it. Because you see it, and you know what's happening. You know what's there from one point of view or another. Okay, we'll get to that. Let's see here. Centrifugal power. Okay, so there, in a sense, there's a kind of centrifugal power, a power going out, which in a sense calls, you know, reaches the bhaktas, and then, of course, the love call of divinity, acts of divine grace, and then just the opposite, a centripetal power, drawing the bhakta in to the mandala, okay? Because after all, where does the bhakta want to go? The bhakta wants to join the dance. I mean, you don't want to stay home when you can be out dancing. I mean, just ask some of the kids in the alley an hour ago. Right? Okay, so, awakening and attraction to the divine in bhakti. Okay, so then there's the circumferential power. Okay, this power to go you know, around, and it, which is what we do in parikrama, right? We go to the place of pilgrimage from the outer world to the inner world, and when we get to the inner sanctum of the temple, we circumambulate, right? Anyone who's been on pilgrimage in India knows that that's what you do. You circumambulate the place of the deity. Centrifugal power. I believe that's a neologism. I don't think it's actually a word until just now. Okay? So what I'm trying to point out here, which is a little hard to see here, this, the arrows pointing to the center, this kind of this drawing into the very center, into the depths of the yantra, and it's sort of infinite. There's no amount of closeness to the divine that is adequate in bhakti. And part of love means that you can't ever overcome the mystery of the beloved, that you're always desiring to be closer and closer. It can never be close enough. And thus the concept of viraha is there as most prominent, because no matter how, you may be right there with Krishna, but there's still viraha. Because you can't be close enough. And that's, and the yantra, I think, beautifully expresses this kind of this kind of endless capacity to move into the center. Meditation on the divine couple and source of love. Okay, so I think for the bhakti, again, the mandala, the ras mandala, functions this way. Okay, so there's my can you cut the lights for a second there? Is it okay? Now I think you can see a little bit better now, right? That's good. Okay, does anyone know what I added? Okay, now I'm going to show you a bunch of renditions of the Ras Mandala, many paintings, okay? And you're going to see all kinds of stuff added to, like, other musicians, animals. I mean, practically, you know, I think there's one with Obama in it. And, anyway, but... he's our president, by the way, in case any of you didn't notice. In America, we don't have a prime minister, but, again, that's fine.
Would it be the...
What's that?
Would it be Radha and Krishna in the center?
Yes. But say, what? Yes. Not Krishna. Krishna's at the center, right? So he's okay. Right? Because he was at the center.
Oh, you added...
I added Radha. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Now, who the hell am I to do that? Now, you know, it's funny, because when I was conferring with my wonderful Indian artist, she grew up in Rajasthan, and she was trained in this art from very young age. But this was a difficult thing. She went back to Rajasthan, to Jaipur, to do this painting. She revisited her masters to help her with this. And it's all done on handmade cotton and jute board, all hand-ground pigments. And all the gold is actual gold. And even around, you can't see it so well in this, but the different sort of halos or nimbi, whatever. And it's all gold there. And the moon is silver, and the stars are silver. Anyway, it's absolutely gorgeous. The original is absolutely gorgeous. It's hanging in my house right now. So
what's the size of it?
The size is all, is that's a little larger. Actually, that's a little larger. It's about like this. So what happens is that each of these figures, it's like a little miniature in and of itself, but it's a kind of aggregate of miniatures. It's absolutely beautiful. And you can blow up, like the front of my book, the Princeton artist took this figure and blew it up, and it looks gorgeous on the front of the book. It's probably around here somewhere. Anyway, but yes, I added this figure, because the artist said she basically refused to paint it without her in the middle. What was I to do? Find another artist? I don't think so. Okay, so
But I found it interesting. Like, oh my gosh, she won't even paint it without Radha in the middle. It was unthinkable. And that was sort of the beginning of my thinking about Rasmandala renditions and all the variations. And the very fact that Radha has to be there in the middle is... and of course, there's absolutely no allusion, not even a hint, no mention whatsoever of any gopi entering into the middle, right? So, there she is. But the rest of it's totally accurate, okay? I mean, you know, you've got the celestials showering down flowers right where they should be, right? You got the full moon. There are no other extraneous animals around, as you'll see in other renditions and so on. So, it was unavoidable, though, to... Radha's there, and she's...
One Krishna for every two gopis, or
okay, good, good. Yes, I'm answering yes to both. You know, it's one of those. Is it this way or is it that way? Yes, it is both. Okay, yeah. Okay, so So the idea is that in the earlier formation of the Rasmandala, Krishna enters in between each pair of gopis. Later, about 15 verses later, it's explaining that each gopi has a Krishna. So, of course, this gives... And then Vishwanatha comes along, yes. Two gopis have a Krishna, each gopi has a Krishna, and then there are two Krishnas that have a gopi. He just... completes the whole, you know. And in other words, in a way, to start to do a rendition of the beginning of the Rasmandala, you have to paint it this way, because it's described that Krishna has his arms on the shoulders of each gopi. Now, if you had Krishna in between each gopi, you'd have Krishna's arms overlapping his own arm. He'd be, you know, embracing each gopi twice. Now, that doesn't make any sense. So in a way, when it starts out, it's this way. But when they really get dancing, I mean, they're really like swinging, right? And they're singing, too. They're singing. The celestials provide the percussion, the necessary percussion for a good, you know, dance performance. Everyone needs some drums around the place, you know? And they were also singing in the background. So there's this kind of, you know, orchestrated celestial event, but yet it's not up there. It's not happening up there. It's happening on the ground. So again, a kind of tantric flavor to this. I feel is strongly there, but yet it's subtle. Let's see here. Moving right along here. I mentioned that a 9, an affinity with nature is often expressed in Tantra. The tantric iconographic imagination inspired a vast natural world where nothing is inaccessible, whose symbolism is uninhibited but never unnatural, and where the same cosmic force flows through all. So the gopis, when they're separated from Krishna, when Krishna disappears in the earlier part of this lila, they're talking to plants. They're talking to trees, they're talking to plants, they're talking to animals. They even talk to little tiny, eeny-weeny plants when they got desperate. They were talking to the earth. They were talking to everybody. They talked to a deer. So, the affinity with nature. Again, another strong element being expressed there. And then identification with, in Tantra we have the identification with the deity is often found, okay? Interest to awaken divine forces that lie in humans is found in Tantra. Now, of course, this is done in a sort of oblique way. When the gopis were missing Krishna, the gopis started imitating Krishna. And they would even play Krishna. And they say, I'm Krishna. Now, they didn't really, you know, think they were Krishna. But the other gopis would see this and were very convinced, yes, that's exactly it. That's exactly the way he would do it, right? That's what they were saying. So in a way, again, mirroring the Tantra sort of approach, this Leela has an ability to be tantric and not tantric. It also has the ability to be mokshic and not mokshic. It's sort of interesting. So in bhakti, you don't have full-fledged tantra, no. In bhakti, you don't have full-fledged mukti either. It's an interest. My thesis would be, one of them, would be that bhakti is a very peculiar combination of the two. It's an amalgam of the two. But they're half-hearted, tantra-wise and moksha-wise. Because a bhakti doesn't care about liberation. He or she doesn't care. I just love Krishna. I just love my Lord, right? Here, there, who cares, right? So it can be here, and that's sort of tantric in a way. Along the lines, I guess, of a jivan mukta, you know, kind of thing. But again, it's not. It might be more jivan tantra. You know, it's more affirming, world affirming, in a piece of this kind. Then I'm going to just wind up by talking about this visualization. Let's just go a little further here. So this is just a blow up of my piece that I had designed with the artist, but and showing again the sort of movement toward the center. And if you look at the Brahma Samhita, really a very tantrically influenced text, where there is a whole yantra actually described, if anyone has read that text, it brings the whole, and I won't get the elaborate 10 directions, 8 it folds, this and that, it brings it to the center, a particular Gayatri mantra is separated out into the different petals, blah, blah, blah. Right at the center is Radha and Krishna, and then at the center of them is the Bija mantra. Anyone remember? Anyone read this?
Klim.
That's right. Klim. You're going to get an A today, except the stress signal you sent out earlier. Not good. So, Klim. Yes, Klim. So, again, it just bespeaks. I think the tantric dimensions of the Ras Mandala, I would claim, and the Ras Leela, I think easily move the tradition into more tantric expressions, like the Brahma Samhita. I tried to look at the elements in the Leela that anticipate that kind of expression. As subtle as they are, I figured, you know what, they got to be there. Okay. Finally, just to run through this, depictions and paintings. So I looked at as many Ras Mandala paintings as I could, right? So I divided them up into the viewer's angle of the Ras Mandala, variations. So there are many viewer angles. There are variations in the mandala circle of dancers, okay? So the actual circle is actually varied quite a bit. Variations at the center of the mandala. Sometimes there's no Krishna or Radha. Sometimes there's just Krishna. Sometimes Krishna's playing the flute. He doesn't play the flute in the middle. In fact, that's anathema. Krishna plays the flute at the beginning to get the gopis to come. Not when he's got the gopis. But you know what? Who am I to say? This is what the artist imagines, right? Maybe he or she figured that the sounding of the flute would somehow conduct the dance. I mean, right? Who am I to say? I'm not there like the bhakta is, right? So, let me go back. And then finally, variations of compositional elements. So, you know, these are all the different things. These are the four ways that the depictions vary. And I'm going to just take you through it very quickly. The viewer's angle of the Ras Mandala. High aerial view, partial aerial view, low aerial ground view, practically the ground, and then ground level. Okay? And it has different effects. So look, you're right on top of this one. I mean, you're like right on top, right? Okay? Okay.
Partial aerial view. Low aerial or ground view, practically, right? I mean, doesn't it feel like you're kind of on a little knoll and you're about to, right? Right? Can you, are you about to go in there? You're right. You're about. I can tell. Right. I can feel his energy. He wanted. Right. See. Okay. Good. And then. I mean, look. I mean, you just gotta. It's wet where we are sitting right now, but
we could just go through the river and splash into that.
Now, ground level's is a necessity with sculpture. So how are you gonna, right? You got to do ground level. Because sculpture doesn't really allow for much else. This is in the ISKCON temple in Mayapur, which is rare to find the Ashtagopis, Ashtasakhi, the eight assistant gopis to Radha, all, you know, in a worship context. I'm not even sure if I know of any other context. It's quite beautiful. Then composite presentations. You have the Ras Mandala with all these other leelas again surrounding it. So the other leelas themselves become a mandala around the mandala. There's another one. Look at this. You got four gopis in the middle here with Sri Nathji. Okay, figure that one. Okay. I mean, you know, let's party. Okay. Okay. So right, all these variations. Okay, variations in the mandala circle of dancers. Okay, so here you've just got Krishna. You know, I think is he playing the flute? No, he's holding. No, he's just dancing, right? So he's having fun in the middle. Gopis are dancing around, but you know that that Krishna is there with each gopi because you know that's what they're dancing. That's the person with whom they're dancing. Now look at this. Look at this. You've got gopis playing, you know, a bandstand there. It just says, like, I mean, there's no discussion of this. There are no gopis coming and playing drums and cymbals and a veena? No way. No. No veena's ever mentioned. This is ridiculous. But no, but they're there. You don't know it, but they're there. We don't know it, but they're there, right? For this artist, they were there. Meditational visualizations. There. This is actually. Where did I pick this up? Somewhere. But it's an attempt to place the mantras utilized in bhakti worship in a mandala form. So I didn't make this. Someone else made it. Even the Maha Mantra. Okay. Which is so popularly chanted, is itself circuitous, and frankly, it's the only mantra I know of that works in a circuitous fashion of that kind. And of course, you have dramatic presentations. So these are the different ways that the mandala is reenacted. So in mantra, in actual performances, this is in a pilgrimage drama in Vrindavan. Sculptural presentations, and you can see here, this is it's sort of a layered mandalas. Variations at the center of the mandala. Krishna said, hey, I'm not going to stand out here alone. I'm going to get into the mandala. Okay, and he's right there dancing along. And there's another one of that kind. So, you know, Krishna's often, he leaves the center. But then he says, hey, no, I want to be in the center. Oh, I want Radha in the center with me. Okay? Let's bring someone else in here. Let's get a competition going. I mean, who knows, right? These are all variations. And then, of course, you've got, remember you saw that earlier, the four gopis in there. See if you can notice differences between this one and... Look at that. I mean, we've got a lineup. Get online to dance with Krishna. And so we've got, you know, an unlimited number of gopis around. And again, we've got some that I think are playing instruments. I can't quite see. Yes, they're playing instruments. See that? Again, we've got a musical accompaniment. So
I'm just going to go do this quickly because this is basically a diagrammatizing of the whole Ras Lila. And I've done work in the past here. I think I gave a lecture about 4 years ago on pilgrimage and the way it's parallel to yoga meditation and how you go deep to the center and then you see the circumambulation around the center. And then, of course, when you go really deep to the into the center, you enter into like a mandala of a different order. And this is the esoteric lila. This produces the esoteric. So you're going from the outer to the inner to the innermost. And I've shown in my book, Dance of Divine Love, that the Ras, I claim that the Ras Lila is itself, while it's the greatest lila of the Bhagavata, it functions, and while it's at the pinnacle, it functions as a doorway to the esoteric lilas. And it's the basis on which so many dramas have been written, so much poetry, Chandidas, Vidyapati, Govindadas, so many of these poets, they have the visions of the lila, the intimate Radhakrishna lila, incorporating Jaidev, Gita Govinda, and so on. And then, of course, you go back out, right? Tirtha, right? You leave. So that's the returning. So then also you have, this is from my book, right? This is I speak about the various scriptural texts having relative importance to the Bhagavata, which is right here at the center. And then, of course, of all the lilas, the rasa is in the very center. And if you pierce that, you go into all of the esoteric lila that is contained in poetry, narrative, and so on, in art. And so the art that we've been looking at in many ways is up here, even though it's something that was inspired down there. It's that artistic imagination. It's the personalizing of the lila. And so here, finally, I just diagrammatize it, more of what we just talked about. Yantra, and then finally in yoga, and so on. So that's pretty much it. You're going to ask, are there any questions?
I have a
supposed to run. Well, no, you're supposed to run it, not take over.
Yeah. Okay. Anyone have a question? Or a comment? Or accommodations? Comments? Yes.
I was reading something in Edward Dimmock's book, The Place of the Hidden Moon, with regard to the Brahma Samhita, where he somewhat curiously sort of concludes that because of its use of yantric terminology and imagery, that's clear indication of it's not just tantric, but left-handed tantric associations. So it would seem that on his line of reasoning, even the Bhagavatam might have some Sahajiya influence. Do you have anything to...
I would probably... Now, he is my revered teacher, and I don't want to be disrespectful, but I don't agree. he was heavily focused on the Sahajiya and the unorthodox school of Bengal Vaishnavism. I think that since he wrote that book, some corrections had been given, particularly by Joe O'Connell. And I think those historical corrections could influence a reinterpretation of those materials. But I'd have to look into that. Right off the bat, my feeling is that, the left-handed tantra just doesn't seem to show up in the Brahma Samhita at all. So I'm hard-pressed to find that. So I'd have to look and see what exactly he said. You got my curiosity going now. I'll have to look at that. Yeah. But clearly, there's no left-handed tantra in anything that I've talked about here. And again, I think the bhakti tradition only, utilizes the tantra as it facilitates, the cultivation of bhakti. So, but I'll look into that. Interesting. Thank you.
Really interesting. For me, I was really struck, actually, listening to your talk about the connection of them moving in into the inner and the outer, I was really struck by its parallel to the Tamil tradition, especially the Tamil poetic tradition, where you have the division, the poetic divisions of literally in the aham, which is the inner world of love, and the puram, which is the outer public world.
Okay, yes.
And it's something that Andal uses in the Tirupave to great effect, where she literally moves in, where she creates Gokula, and she moves you to the inner world, and what you find at the inner heart once you go to Krishna's house is Krishna and Napinna in their bedroom, and she says to her, this is, or not she, but the gopis say to Napinna and Krishna, or rather she first addresses Krishna saying, come on, wake up, you know, we're here. And then she says, she realizes, or the gopis realize that that's not right. And so then they address Napinna saying, well, it's not fair that you're hogging him, because we're here and it's our turn now, so open the door so we can come in.
Yes.
And once you do that, they come out again. They come out of the inner world, back out, and then they have the bath that you never see.
Right.
And then what do they? Then they go to see Krishna, and then it's again an interior world, but Krishna is now
so
as the king.
Movement back,
it's the moving back and marvelous. Forth. And you see that same thing repeated in the Natchayathirumurai, her other work as well, but configured somewhat slightly differently. So I think the movement, and of course Dennis Hudson has talked about both the Tirupave and Natchayathirumurai in terms of Pancharatra, as opposed to just Tantra in general. And I think that might
Which
be
is very tantric.
Yes, definitely, it's the Pancharatra tradition. Text. So I think, and especially as you see Ramanuja moving more to the Pancharatra, you know, with the development of Vishnu.
Right.
So I think that might be a really interesting way to parallel the Bhagavata Purana in terms of, because the Arvars use the space, and of course the Aham and Puram material really effectively, and I think the ways in which the Bhagavata itself employs those inner outer realms might be a very useful kind of dialogic partner.
Marvelous.
And so I thought of that, and also with regard to the emerald, the Maragatha.
Yeah, do you like that?
Yes, I love that. but Namarvar uses it all the time.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, and in fact, all of the Arvars, but in particularly Namarvar.
When you say use that, do you mean the exact phrase? Maragatha?
They use usually my gem, my ruby, my Maragatha is usually how it'll come.
Is that
yen
right?
Yen Manikame, Yen Maniye, Yen Maragatha Me.
Okay, Tamil.
Yes,
in right, okay.
Well, the Sanskrit word. So it's Maragatha is the word.
Oh,
Maragatham.
Mixed in with the Tamil.
Yeah, no, it'll come usually in some sequence like Yen Manikyame, Yen Maniye, Yen Maragathame. It'll come in three usually sequences. So Manikyame is like my gem, my ruby, it's sort of the generic.
This makes
like
me want to learn Tamil.
Everybody should be required to learn Tamil.
Yeah.
So Yen Manikyame.
I figured Bengali and Sanskrit would be enough, but now I got to learn Tamil.
So Yen Manikyame, Yen Maragathame is usually all the time.
Marvelous.
Maragathame is something that they use all the time to talk about his lustrous color. And but never, there's actually one, I think it's Namarvar or Thirumanga, where he's actually referred to as green as a parrot.
Oh, is that right? Green as a parrot. Beautiful. Beautiful.
So, but I can't remember.
But let me ask you, so do you think that... So I invoke really these three layers, outer, inner, and innermost. In fact, I even do this in my comments on the Bhagavad Gita.
Right?
Do you remember that? And you're reading it? Right. So is there something akin to innermost?
Definitely.
Oh, definitely.
In the Tirupave, it comes in the commentary of tradition
too juicy.
There are some very sleepy girls and they're not coming out.
Yeah.
And so the commentators will say, oh, she's not sleeping. The commentators in the voice of Andal will say, oh, she's already enjoyed Krishna. She's enjoying him in the house. And that's why it's, you know, the smell of the fragrance of the tulasi is everywhere, because he has been there, but he's disappeared. And so she's in this kind of stupor of having enjoyed him.
Right.
So nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
Right.
And then she says, come on, come out, it's not fair. So this idea of enjoyment, and of course the innermost is the world where Napinne and Krishna are together.
Right.
In this really intimate, I mean, it's a very, very intimate scene where it describes her. He describes, Andal describes it as Krishna lying on the breasts of Nakine. That's how she describes. She's there with her beautiful flower-adorned hair. And she says all the lamps are burning and she's lying on the Panchashayana, the bed with five qualities.
Right.
You are sleeping like this with your head resting on the breasts of Napine.
Right.
And your garland, so they're like entwined.
Yeah.
So she's like, wake up. Now it's our turn to be there with you. So there's, I think the inner and innermost are...
Mm-hmm. So there can be that, okay.
Yeah, so I think it's
marvelous.
It's complicated in many ways in Andal in particular. I mean, I was immediately struck by this.
Interesting.
I mean, especially because she's the one who uses the gopi. No Ras Leela, obviously, but...
Right.
But she uses the gopi stuff.
Marvelous. Well, I'm going to have to get some references from you later. Sure. Excellent. Thank you for that.
Yes.
I think I've talked with you enough today. Okay. I'll forget the
button. It's his chance.
Okay. Right. Good point. Very good point.
I was wondering about this passage that you were talking about the gopi drawing Krishna within her mind and then closing her eyes.
Ah, yes, right.
It seems like most of the writings on the Bhagavatam have emphasized how the Bhagavatam is giving an emotional bhakti that is based on you could say, the senses in some ways, the senses being absorbed in Krishna. And it being a very central form of bhakti. Now this passage seems to contradict that. It seems to be saying, well, okay, now this is the pinnacle scene where one of the gopis comes in front of Krishna and they're there together, but she decides to close her eyes and see him in meditation. And this seems to go sort of opposite to the bhakti that the Bhagavatam is presenting.
Yes. Well, that's why I found it so fascinating. Mm. But it became obvious to me, this is my interpretation, that she's tired of having all these other gopis around. I just want to be alone. The only place I can be alone with Krishna is right in here. Because this friend of mine's here, this friend of mine's here, they're all over the place, and they're all gazing at Krishna. I said, you know what, I'm tired of this stuff. I'll take a shot, a little digital shot, and then I'll say, okay, now. That's my interpretation. I didn't read a commentary that said that. You know what? Maybe I did. I'd have to read my book again. I don't remember what I said in the book.
But I don't know that they're mutually exclusive, one and the other, right? I mean, I'm sorry to go back to. I'm just drowning in Alvar.
No, this is great. This is great.
I think because especially in Namalvar, he's constantly oscillating between this kind of deep emotional kind of viraha of vishlesha, and then you have the kind of yogic vision that he has where he's sort of seeing Krishna, or rather Narayana, inside of him, and he has the same phrase of even the gods who are the unblinking ones, they can see him so much, but can they really see all of his many forms? He asks this question. So I think, they're not... I know.
It's great stuff. Yeah.
I don't think one, it's mutually exclusive. I don't think that it's, either bhakti or yoga. I think, they are meant to be seen as complementary.
I think bhakti makes them so.
Yeah.
Whereas I think there's parts of yoga that really... I mean, later medieval traditions of bhakti can't stand yoga.
Yeah.
They can't stand it. Because by that time, in post-classical, period of yoga, they're getting involved in, all kinds of yoga tricks and the physical part of yoga is, it's like America. It's like America now. You know what I mean? It's just so emphasized. The Hatha Yoga Pradipika, was the beginning of that, right? And the proliferation of postures and sort of more external posturing, but yes, I think in the Bhagavata, yoga is very compatible. Exactly what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Also
in the Alvars.
With Namalvar, he's all about it. I mean,
he brings in yoga, engages?
Not yoga in the sense... Yeah, but definitely about meditation. Oh, okay. All, especially in the Trivandrum, it's all about this kind of inner contemplation. Right. And he oscillates.
Marvelous.
In fact, there's, you know, the late, the 13th century Acharya Hridayam, which is all a kind of commentary on Namalvar, says...
Oh, okay.
Works on, he says, samshleshatil penpeche, I'm sorry, samshleshatil tanpeche, vishleshatil avarpeche. That is, in Vishlesha, he speaks in the voice, that is, Namalvar speaks in the voice of a woman, but when he's in samshlesha, he speaks in the voice, his own voice. So this idea, therefore, but they're both the same, that they're both his nature, because the nature of the soul is to be dependent on God.
Mm.
So it expresses, it's expressive of this paratantriya.
Beautiful, beautiful.
So,
You know, Dr. Velpe, I consider a good friend of mine, but I don't always trust him. So, is it true you're working with Frank on the Tiruvaimoli translation?
Yeah, we're
okay,
about.
So you're right. That's right. Okay, so now.
Yes.
That's marvelous. That's
very
marvelous.
Slowly.
Well, you know, very slow. Well, it's a big work. I just got through doing a review for Stanford for his book.
Which one?
That will be coming out. It's I even wrote him an email. I said, Frank, I'm reviewing your book.
Oh.
You know, but you're not supposed to tell anyone. But I was going to give him a good review because
right.
I read it. And I said, this is great. You know, so I told him I was just getting it done. But this is a book where he's comparing. Stanford has a series. He was invited to write this for a certain series, but it's comparing. To the Tiruvaimoli with the Song of Solomon.
Oh, yes.
He told you that,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Well, it's quite a little adventuresome text. He does things that you don't expect, which, Frank, you expect that.
Well, I mean, it's the way the truth of
what you don't expect.
Yeah,
right, exactly. Yeah. But, wow, I'm glad you're doing this. Do you know when you're going to be done? It's a large work.
Soon.
Yeah, soon.
Soon.
Yeah, I've heard that before.
I have to finish my other Namalvar first. So.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So. But I also thought that you mentioned the verse with the mandala where they're opening the mandala.
Oh, yes.
Opening.
Rasotsava Sampravita.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, with the opening like flowers, and I thought that tied into the first verse that you quoted. Where the night blooming blossoms.
Oh, right. Yes. Yeah, there's a kind of mirroring there. That's right, a returning to it. Right, yeah. The imagery of blossoming and opening, again, has a very yantra-like feeling to it. And then there's also this centripetal force. So you've got all these dynamics going on, and I think that's. I think if you absorb all of them at once, you're in kind of a bhakti samadhi, I imagine.
Else?
Dr. Velpe, you had a question?
Yeah, I was thinking about, okay, in the tantric picture that we're getting yantras which are very symmetrical and circular, and there's going in and there's going out,
right,
and there's going around.
Yeah.
But then I was thinking about what David Haberman says about pilgrimage in Braj.
In Journey Book?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where he says it's actually unlike other kinds of pilgrimage, where you're going to a specific place. You're actually wandering aimlessly.
Yeah.
In Braj. I think he uses the word aimless.
Yes,
but you're getting lost.
Right, right.
So I'm wondering if there's some way to bring
archetypal?
That together with
okay.
all of this symmetry and circularity.
Well, okay. I mean, to me, what he's talking about is something that's archetypal of the gopis when they're searching for Krishna.
Exactly.
Right. I mean, that's
but
what they do. They got
the
lost in the forest. They're looking everywhere. Then finally the moon was even going down. So they couldn't see. They had to go back. Right? They're getting lost. So now, in a way, I see this as the gopis... trying to move toward they're not getting lost. I mean, they're getting lost, but they're not getting lost because they think they're finding Krishna, but they're not. And then they move back, and then they go somewhere else. They're getting closer, but then they're not. And then See, it's an elliptical movement, back and forth, closer, further, and so this dialectical movement between closerness and furtherness is constant. And then even with Krishna, and you were mentioning this something that reminded me of one of Dimmock's translated poems with Levertov, you know, in praise of Krishna, right? So one poem is talking about how Krishna and Radha were lying there, and it just paints this beautiful scene, and suddenly Radha just breaks out and she starts wailing, and Krishna's like. and this scene of Radha wailing and missing Krishna so much is so pathetic that in the bunny ta, right, the signature line, Govinda Das walks into the poem and walks Radha softly away. I mean, how pathetic. I mean, even me, I'm like going, oh, this is like, I mean. So anyway, it's just one of my favorites, right? And so it's just so the way the tradition works with these poetic tropes is so powerful and so beautiful, really. And certainly for the bhakti traditions of the north, they draw from the Ras Lila, and then, you know, the Govinda Das, I think, is the one who wrote this particular poem. But no, it's great stuff. It's great stuff. So yeah, there. I mean, yes, you're getting lost, but you're getting lost like a gopi. You're not just getting lost, not like me in Oxford. Like, when I get lost in Oxford, I'm really lost. Really, really lost, okay? That's a different...
That's when you'll find Krishna.
You're very optimistic. Thank you for that. Okay? But my friends know me better. Okay, so, but the point is that this getting lost is really getting found. Because after all, you're in Braj. Right. Remember,
speechless. He's on sabbatical.
You just spoke. You told me you were speechless. See, the paradoxes abound. Yeah, they do.
So, okay. If nothing further, then. Many thanks indeed.
Well, thank you. This is great. Your comments. Thank you.